This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
I wonder what that was.
Oh, monkey boy. Hey, monkey boy.
Ja,
Wow. All right. Well, what was that? The more astute listeners out there will, of course, immediately recognize it as the traditional Balinese monkey dance, as performed by the villagers of Peliatan on the island of Bali in the Indonesian archipelago. And this dance, I wish you could have seen the traditional dancers jumping around impersonating an army of monkeys on YouTube. And, of course, you can if you check out the video on YouTube. This is where they impersonate monkeys in the monkey dance to perform the final scene, the big climactic scene from the Hindu epic, the Ramayana, in which the army of monkeys led by Hanuman build a causeway across the strait separating the Indian mainland from the island of Ceylon and attack the evil forces of the Rakshasis, or the demons of the demon king Ravana, and rescue the captured goddess Sita on behalf of Rama. Well, I've sort of been on this monkey kick of late because I've been reading the classic Chinese folk novel Journey to the West by Wu Cheng'en, writing in the 16th century. But the stories are very, very old, and probably I would conjecture that the hero of Journey to the West, Sun Wukong, probably traces his lineage in mythology and folklore back to the Hindu monkey god Hanuman. They're both flying, super-powered, fighting monkeys, and they both serve as loyal servants in the respective epics of the Ramayana and Journey to the West. Hanuman serving as the servant of the god Rama, who was attempting to win back his wife Sita, who has been abducted by the Rakshasas, and Sun Wukong serving as servant of the Buddhist monk, the wandering Buddhist monk Tripitaka. But there is actually a significant difference between the two characters in that Hanuman is an exemplar of selfless piety and righteous behavior, and is completely heroic, whereas Sun Wukong has got a mischievous and naughty monkey nature. He's much more like a real monkey, which he's always struggling to conquer, and keeps getting into trouble and going too far throughout the many pages of Journey to the West. So he's much more like a real monkey. And in the end, of course, he does conquer his monkey nature and achieves immortality. So hopefully I've got a lot to get through tonight. Hopefully I'm going to actually do some readings from Journey to the West. Now, Journey to the West is very, very long, and I still haven't actually read the work in its entirety. But there are lots of... I've actually collected various editions of it because they all have different stories. It's a collection of stories, although they're all tied together in a single narrative thread. So as with, you know, the Arabian Nights Entertainment, if you don't actually want to slog your way through the thousands of pages of the original, of course I couldn't read it in the original because it's in Chinese, and 15th century Chinese at that, 16th century. So, the way to do it is to collect various editions, because all of the editions tell different stories and different versions of the stories. So I'm going to hopefully delve a little bit tonight into some of the stories from Journey to the West by Wu Cheng'en, and we'll read more about the super-powered flying monkey Sun Wukong. a little bit of background, if I can get through it quickly enough to still have time to do the readings. What I find really fascinating, and the reason I'm opening with the Pelyaton Kechak monkey dance. Kechak means monkey, by the way, in Indonesian. Is sort of make the point that, you know, how old these stories are and that, you know, mythology is built upon mythology. Because almost certainly there's got to be a link between Sun Wukong and Hanuman. And in fact, there is speculation that the Ramayana, the classic Hindu epic itself, was perhaps inspired by or influenced by the Iliad of Homer. Which a very similar plot. Very similar plot. I mean, of course, in Homer, it's the wife of Menelaus, the Greek king, who is abducted to Troy, sparking the Trojan War across the water from Greece, and in the Ramayana, it's the wife of Rama who is abducted across the water to Ceylon, or Lanka, as it's called. Its ancient name having been revived today, Sri Lanka, Sri being an honorific. And there are other similarities which have been pointed out, such as at the end of the Odyssey, which is the sequel to the Iliad, of course, when Odysseus returns home to Ithaca, he proves that it's really him after being lost at sea for 10 years and thereby wins back his wife by stringing a magical bow, which only he had the power to string. And similarly, at the beginning of the Ramayana, Rama does exactly the same thing in order to win his wife Sita in the first place, because she's a goddess. So he has to prove that he is immortal. And he strings a magical bow, which only an immortal could string. So not coincidence. Probably, there was some communication in the ancient world. Homer probably wrote somewhere between 1000 and 800 BCE, before the Common Era, and the Ramayana was written by the sage Valmiki, probably around 500 BCE, and in the Ramayana, as we say, Sita is abducted away to Ceylon, and Rama, in order to raise an army to hunt her down, is forced to make an alliance where he can, because he's been exiled to the forest, and he... looking for a clip on the internet here. Let's see here. He makes an alliance with a monkey race known as the Vanara. And nobody knows too much about who or what the Vanara were, but they're always represented as monkeys. And let's see, possibly they represented a previous indigenous people of India who were there before the Indo-Aryan invaders arrived. Nobody knows exactly what their language sounded like, but it's believed to have sounded something like this.
Yo, Sarisa Taka.
What's Sarisa Taka?
Tisa, Tisasa, Tusa, Tusasa, Doma, Gosa, Nichi.
Something like that. That's probably what the language of the Vanara sounded like, according to the latest studies which have been undertaken into the matter. So, the most valiant of the Vanaras is Hanuman, and he's sent out as a, they don't know exactly where Sita is, so Hanuman is sent out as a scout, and he tracks her down to Lanka, where she is being held captive by Ravana, who is the king of the Rakshasas, who are a demonic race who inhabit Lanka. Apparently, the people of northern India, Ayodhya, which is where Rama reigned as king, were not too crazy about the people down in Lanka, Ceylon. They viewed them as demons. So, in a pretty spectacular scene, Hanuman flies across the ocean, because he can fly, and he flies across the sea and lands in Lanka and tracks down Sita and comforts her and says, don't worry, we're going to rescue you. And then he flies back and they get the whole monkey army together. And the monkey army, as you just heard, the villagers of Paliyatan, Bali, reenacting the scene, the monkey army, well, they can't all fly across the sea because only Hanuman is a flying monkey, but they build a causeway across the sea and they attack, they attack Lanka and they rescue Sita with, of course, Rama and his brothers as well. So, you know, there was probably, according to the works of the retelling, I've also read several retellings of the Ramayana. According to the retelling by Aubrey Menon, which is actually the most amusing, he's sort of arguing that the Ramayana itself was a sort of an effort to reincorporate into the reigning orthodoxy of the Indo-Aryan imposed caste system. Significant rebellion against that system. And this has a lot to do with the origins of Buddhism and the premise of Journey to the West. So, see if I can briefly explain. The, caste system had already been in place, ever since the Indo-Aryan invasion of the Indian subcontinent, thousands of years earlier, probably something like 5,000 years earlier. And, of course, it was held that the highest caste, the Brahmins, were essentially gods, and they reigned supreme, although the kings and the warriors were the next class down from them, actually, the Kshatriyas. And then you had, you know, lower caste going down the ladder all the way to the untouchables. Eventually, just around this same time, beginning around 1,000 years BCE, before Common Era, there were a series of sort of spiritual rebellions against the caste system and against the whole ideology of the Vedas, which held it in place. And the first most significant of these was that of the Upanishads. The sages of the Upanishads were sort of hippies who that was sort of had a hippie ethic. They sort of had a dropout ethic, and they just wanted to like go to the forest and seek enlightenment. And this became more and more popular until it was actually sort of a threat to the reigning system, and it needed to be co-opted. And that was sort of what the Ramayana was about, because Rama is a king or a prince, and therefore a member of the Kshatriya class, but he's exiled. He's forced from his throne, and he's exiled into the forest, and he takes refuge with the sages who dwell there seeking enlightenment and becomes their protector until his wife is kidnapped by the demon, and he's forced to go to war, and the monkeys befriend him, and he wins back his throne. So the whole warrior ethic and the royalty system is vindicated at the end of the book, but nonetheless, the sages dwelling in the forest are treated with a great deal of respect. And In fact, the Upanishads were sort of incorporated into the Vedas. And according to Aubrey Menon, their original message was sort of corrupted, so it would not threaten the reigning system. Now, the next most significant revolt against the system was that of Gautama Buddha a couple of centuries later. And the Buddhists were... they had a bit more of a of an activist and moralist ethic than the sages of the Upanishads had. They were concerned with achieving personal enlightenment, but they were also deeply concerned with alleviating suffering, even here in the material world. And they were much more proselytizers than the sages of the Upanishads had been. So they actually made... they actually did shake up the system a little bit, and under the Maurya Empire of ancient India, they actually became the state religion briefly before the orthodoxy reasserted itself after a couple of centuries. So, actually not that briefly, but in the great span of Indian history, quite briefly. So, and also about this same time... that the Maurya Empire ruled in India and Buddhism became the state religion, the Han Empire ruled in China, and Buddhism entered China through the Silk Road. And there was a big flowering of Buddhist culture there. And then a few centuries after that, the Huns arrived on the scene, and they harassed both the borders of China and India and caused dynasties to fall, and the Silk Road collapsed, and contact between India and China collapsed. Around the year 619, the Tang Dynasty comes to power in China and begins to rebuild centralized rule and a degree of stability for the first time in an interlude of several centuries. And at exactly this time, there was a monk by the name of San Zhang who decides that he goes from monastery to monastery. And he compares the Buddhist texts, the sutras, and finds that that he believes that they've been corrupted. He finds that they don't quite match, and that what somebody needs to do, now that a degree of stability is reappearing in the world, somebody needs to go to India and get the original texts. But it's going to be a very, very perilous journey, because the Silk Road hasn't been open for centuries. And there hasn't really been any contact between India and China for centuries. So it's going to be a very perilous journey. But nonetheless, he does it. San Zhang leaves Chang'an, which was the capital of the Tang Dynasty, contemporary city of Xi'an, in which is the capital of the province of Shanxi, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, in 619. And he returns in the year 645. Common era. So he was gone a good long time, and he passes through the kingdoms of Kansu, Turfan, Karashar. He crosses the Pamir and Tian Shan mountains, enters Central Asia, stops in Samarkand, which had once been the hub of the Silk Road, and then he enters contemporary Afghanistan, stops in Kunduz and Balkh, and Bamiyan, where the ancient giant Buddhas were, which were unfortunately destroyed by the Taliban back in 2001, crosses into what's now Pakistan, stops at Peshawar and Gandhara, and then into the Punjab, stops at Srinagar, and then into India proper, Prayag, which is now Allahabad, and and Bengal and Orissa. And similarly, the Gupta dynasty in India has also recently collapsed. In Afghanistan, this was just before, in fact, just about a generation before the Arabs invaded and brought Islam. So it's still it's a patchwork of small kingdoms throughout this entire region. And in fact, Sanzang becomes mixed up in internecine court royalties between the king of Assam and the king of Kanpur, which is today in the state of Uttar Pradesh. Nonetheless, he, after what was, in fact, a very perilous journey in which he battled bandits and pirates and wild animals and demons, so he wrote in his memoir later on. And we don't know if, in fact, he was hallucinating out in the desert, or if he was just embellishing the story a little bit, or if he actually encountered demons. Who knows? Maybe he really did. He does, in fact, he visits all these different monasteries in India and Afghanistan, and engages in debates with the scholars between the Mahayana and Hinayana schools of Buddhism, and collects texts, which he brings back. Particularly, he stays for a while at Nalanda Buddhist University in the contemporary state of Bihar, then he begins to return back to India. The most tragic part of the whole story is that when he crosses the Indus River, because you see, he had to make this loop through Afghanistan and Central Asia, so he only had to cross the Pamir and Tian Shan mountains, as opposed to having to cross the Himalayas through Tibet, which would have just been too difficult. So he's following the route of the Silk Road. So when he's crossing the Indus River, he's in a shipwreck, and many of the scriptures are lost in the depths of the Indus River. Really, really tragic. But nonetheless, he does succeed in bringing a lot of scriptures back to China, and he is welcomed back in Kanang as a hero by the reigning Tang Emperor Taizong, who builds the Wild Goose Pagoda for these texts which he brought back from India to be stored in, and the texts are translated back into Chinese, and contact with India is reestablished, and scholars go back and forth. And in fact, some indigenous Chinese texts, including the Tao Te Ching, are translated into Sanskrit and brought to India. And finally, he writes all of this down in his memoir, which he entitled The Record of the Western Regions, in which he recounts his journey to the West. And now we fast forward several hundred years, fast forward several centuries to the Ming Dynasty of the 16th century, where Wu Cheng'en writes the novel Journey to the West. And he renames Sanzang Tripitaka, which is pretty much the kind of a loose translation of his name into Sanskrit, meaning three baskets. Not an exact translation, but I believe that either San or Zhang means basket in Chinese. Now, over the centuries, this whole mythology had sprung up around Sanzang, and all of these folk tales, many of which were transformed into operas and performed in Beijing, had grown around his legend. But it was Wu Cheng'en in the 16th century who was the first to write them all down and to assemble them into a single narrative. And there was a certain amount of political satire which was going on, particularly satire of the Ming bureaucracy. particularly of these sort of charlatan Taoists who had insinuated themselves into the Ming court and were being paid very, very handsomely to try to develop elixirs of immortality to make the emperor immortal. They were basically New Age hucksters by in contemporary lingo who were conning the emperor. So Wu Chung'en pokes fun at all of this, but of course he can't do so. He can't do so openly because that would be a good way to get your head cut off. So he has the celestial Jade Emperor, who reigns in heaven in Taoist mythology, sort of as a stand-in for the real Ming Emperor who reigns down on Earth. But it's pretty clear-cut, so it's pretty clear-cut political satire here. So I should state, just taking a sip of water here, I should state that it's 12:32 in the a.m. I wonder if I can get through everything I want to get through in the next hour, if I can keep it rocking along. Tell in brief the story of Journey to the West as retold. I just told you the real story of the monk San Zhang and his real journey to the West back in the 7th century. Now I'm going to see if I can retell very, very briefly in encapsulized form, because it's thousands of pages long, many hundreds of pages long. I think it might be well over 1,000 pages anyway. The story of Journey to the West as it's mythologized with the superpowered monkey Sun Wukong as a major character by the writer Wu Cheng'en in the 16th century. So why don't we begin, as Wu Cheng'en does, with the origin of Sun Wukong. And first I should state that it's 12:33 in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and now we're going to dip into Journey to the West with the origin of Sun Wukong. High atop a mountain, surrounded by favored earth that nourished magic fungi and wild orchids, there came to be a magic stone of immortal dimensions and properties. It was fructified by the seeds of heaven and earth, and by the essences of the sun and moon, until one day it was impregnated by divine inspiration, and became pregnant with a divine embryo. The embryo continued to develop in secret until one day it burst open to reveal a stone egg. Once the egg was exposed to the elements, the wind soon transformed it into a stone monkey, complete in every way and in all aspects of its being. With his first breath, Monkey began to run and climb, and when he bowed to the four quarters, his steely eyes shot two beams of golden light toward the palace of the Pole Star. Those twin shafts of light startled the celestial Jade Emperor, who was sitting with his divine ministers in the miraculous mist of the Cloud Palace of the Golden Arches, which have nothing to do with the corporate golden arches of our time, needless to say. He immediately ordered Thousand League Eye and Wind-Knowing Ears to open the southern gate of heaven and look out. Two captains hurried to the gate, and after looking with sharpened eyes and ever-keen ears, they returned to the holy chamber to make the report. Your Majesty, the light you have seen comes from the borders of the country of Ao Lai, east of the exalted continent, from the mountain of flowers and fruit, where a magic stone gave birth to an egg that was transformed by the wind into a stone monkey, who just now bowed to the four quarters, shooting beams of golden light toward the palace of the Pole Star. But now he is eating, and the light is growing dim. It's nothing surprising, the Jade Emperor said. These creatures from the world below are composed of the essences of heaven and earth, and therefore anything can happen. Monkey was soon climbing trees and picking flowers and fruit, cavorting among the sandy hollows and building sand pagodas, chasing dragonflies and catching small lizards, tearing off creepers and weaving mats and making new friends with the tigers, wolves, monkeys, and bears, and, of course, with the apes and monkeys, like himself. One morning, all the monkeys followed the stream up to its source. It wasn't long before they came to a great waterfall. "Look, look," Monkey shouted, "a white rainbow arching toward the heavens. 1,000 strands of hurling waves, impenetrable by wind. Their breath so cold it divides the green ranges. See how the noble cascade is suspended like a hanging curtain. Marvelous, marvelous water," the monkeys chanted. "Why, it must travel all the way to the bottom of the mountain and extend as far as the sea." After stretching their eyes to the wide horizon, they turned and said, "Why, is any one among us brave enough to penetrate that curtain of water, discover its source, and return to us unharmed? We would make him our king." "Yes, yes," they chanted, sending the challenge out again and again. Finally, after the third call, the stone monkey jumped forward and exclaimed, "I'll go." Without another word, he crouched, screwed up his eyes, and leapt through the waterfall. Well, of course, he was going to rise to the occasion. And there, on the other side of the waterfall, he finds a natural palace carved by erosion out of the side of the mountain, and leads the monkeys there to live, and they make him their king. And he becomes the Handsome Monkey King. That becomes his new title. And he reigns for hundreds of years on the mountains of on the mountain of flowers and fruit. And everybody's very happy until one day he begins crying at the royal banquet. And they ask him what's wrong, and he says that he fears mortality. He's the Handsome Monkey King, but he's not immortal, and he's going to die one day. So he leaves to seek immortality, and he travels and travels and travels for years until he finally finds an enlightened patriarch by the name of Subodhi, who he believes can teach him the key to immortality, and becomes his disciple, and he is given the name, the spiritual name, Sun Wukong, which means, variously translated as aware of vacuity or awakened to emptiness, about the same thing. And I'm going to read the section in which Sun Wukong becomes the special disciple of Subodhi, the enlightened patriarch, and thereby gains magical powers. He's just been given the spiritual name Sun Wukong, and Monkey was so pleased with his new name that he skipped up and down in front of the patriarch, bowing to express his gratitude. Subodhi then ordered his pupils to take Monkey to the outer rooms and teach him how to sprinkle and dust, answer properly when spoken to, how to come in, go out, go around. Then he bowed to his fellow pupils and went out into the corridor, where he made himself a sleeping place. Early the next morning, he and the others practiced the correct mode of speech and bearing, studied the scriptures, discussed doctrine, practiced writing, burnt incense, and in the same way he passed day after day, spending his leisure time in sweeping the floor, hoeing the garden, growing flowers and tending trees, gathering firewood, lighting the fire, drawing water. Everything he needed was provided for him, and so he lived in the cave while time slipped by for 6 or 7 years. One day the patriarch, seated in state, summoned all of his pupils to begin a lecture on the Great Way. Monkey was so delighted by what he heard that he tweaked his ears and rubbed his cheeks. His brow flowered and his eyes laughed. He could not stop his hands from dancing, his feet from stamping. Suddenly the patriarch caught sight of him and shouted, "What is the use of your being here if instead of listening to my lecture you jump up and down and dance like a maniac?" "I am listening with all my might." said Monkey. But you were saying such wonderful things that I could not contain myself for joy. That is why I may, for all I know, have been hopping and jumping. Don't be angry with me. So you recognize the profundity of what I am saying, said the patriarch. How long, pray, have you been in my cave? It may seem rather silly, said Monkey, but I really don't know how long. All I can remember is that when I was sent to get firewood, I went up the mountain behind the cave, and there I found a whole slope covered with peach trees. I have eaten my fill of those peaches 7 times. It is called the Kill of the Bright Peach Blossom, said the patriarch, and if you have eaten there 7 times, I suppose you have been here 7 years. What sort of wisdom are you now hoping to learn from me? Oh, I leave that to you, said Monkey. Any sort of wisdom. It's all the same to me. There are 360 schools of wisdom, said the patriarch, and all of them lead to self-attainment. Which school do you want to study? Just as you think best, said Monkey. I am all attention. Well, what about art? Said the patriarch. Would you like me to teach you that? What sort of wisdom is that? Asked Monkey. You would be able to summon fairies and ride the phoenix, said the patriarch. Divine by shuffling the yarrow stalks, and know how to avoid disaster and pursue good fortune. But should I live forever? Asked Monkey. Certainly not, said the patriarch. Then that's no good for me, said Monkey. How about natural philosophy? Said the patriarch. What is that about? Asked Monkey. It means the teaching of Confucius, said the patriarch, and of the Buddha, and Lao Tzu, and the dualists, and Mo Tzu, and the doctors of medicine, reading scriptures, saying prayers, learning how to have adepts and sages at your beck and call. But should I live forever? Asked Monkey. If that's what you were thinking about, said the patriarch, I am afraid philosophy is no better than a prop in the wall. Master, said Monkey, I am a plain, simple man, and I don't understand that sort of patter. What do you mean by a prop in the wall? When men are building a room, said the patriarch, and want it to stand firm, they put a pillar to prop up the walls. But one day the wall falls and the pillar rots. That doesn't sound much like long life, said Monkey. I'm not going to learn philosophy. How about quietism? Asked the patriarch. What does that consist of? Asked Monkey. Low diet, said the patriarch. Inactivity, meditation, restraint of word and deed, yoga practiced prostrate or standing. But should I live forever? Asked Monkey. The results of quietism, said the patriarch, are no better than unbaked clay in the kiln. You have got a very poor memory, said Monkey. Didn't I tell you just now that I don't understand the sort of patter? What do you mean by unbaked clay in the kiln? The bricks and tiles, said the patriarch, may all be waiting, all shaped and ready in the kiln, but if they have not yet been fired, there will come a day when heavy rain falls and they are washed away. That does not promise well for the future, said Monkey. I don't think I'll bother about quietism. You might try exercises, said the patriarch. What do you mean by that? Asked Monkey. Various forms of activity, said the patriarch, such as the exercises called gathering the yin and patching the yang, drawing the bow and treading the catapult, rubbing the navel to pass breath. Then there are alchemical practices, such as the magical explosion, burning the reeds and striking the tripod, promoting red lead, melting the autumn stone, and drinking bride's milk. Would these make me live forever? Asked Monkey. To hope for that, said the patriarch, would be like trying to fish the moon out of the water. There you go again, said Monkey. What, pray, do you mean by fishing the moon out of the water? When the moon is in the sky, said the patriarch, it is reflected in the water. It looks just like the real thing, but if you try to catch hold of it, But if you try to catch hold of it, you will find that it is only an illusion. That does not sound like much good, said Monkey. I shan't learn exercises. Tut! Cried the patriarch, and coming down from the platform, he caught hold of the knuckle wrapper and pointed it at Monkey, saying, You wretched simian! You won't learn this and you won't learn that. I should like to know what it is that you do want. And so saying, he struck Monkey over the head 3 times. Bang, bang, bang. Then he folded his hands behind his back and strode off into the inner room, dismissing his audience and locking the door behind him. The pupils all turned indignantly upon Monkey. You villainous ape! they shouted at him. Do you think this is the way to behave? The master offers to teach you, and instead of accepting thankfully, you begin arguing with him. Now he's thoroughly offended, and goodness knows when he'll come back. They were all very angry and poured abuse on him. But Monkey was not in the least upset, and merely replied with a broad grin. The truth of the matter was, he understood the language of the secret signs. That was why he did not take up the quarrel or attempt to argue. He knew that the master, by striking him 3 times, was giving him an appointment at the 3rd watch, and by going off with his hands folded behind his back, meant that Monkey was to look for him in the inner apartments. The locking of the door meant that he was to come around by the back door, and would then receive instruction. The rest of the day he frolicked with the other pupils in front of the cave, impatiently awaiting the night. And as soon as dusk came, like the others, he went to his sleeping place. He closed his eyes and pretended to be asleep, breathing softly and regularly. In the mountains, there is no watchman to beat the watches or call the hours. The best Monkey could do was count his incoming and outgoing breaths. When he reckoned it must be about the hour of the rat, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m., he got up very quietly and slipped off his clothes, softly opened the front door, left his companions, and went round to the back door. Sure enough, it was only half shut. The master certainly means to give me instruction, said Monkey to himself. That is why he left the door open. So he crept in and went straight to the master's bed. Finding him curled up and lying with his face to the wall, Monkey dared not wake him and knelt down beside the bed. Presently, the patriarch woke, stretched out his legs, and murmured to himself, "Hard, very hard, the way is most secret. Never handle the golden elixir as though it were a mere toy. He who to unworthy ears entrusts the dark truths, to no purpose works his jaws, and his talks are tongue dry." "Master, I have been kneeling here for some time," said Monkey, when he saw the patriarch was awake. "You wretched monkey," said Subodhi, who, on recognizing his voice, pulled off his bedclothes and sat up. "Why aren't you asleep in your own quarters instead of coming round behind to mine?" "At the lecture today," said Monkey, "you ordered me to come for instruction at the 3rd watch by way of the back gate. That is why I ventured to come straight to your bed." The patriarch was delighted. He thought to himself, "This fellow really must be, as he says, a natural product of heaven and earth. Otherwise, he would never have understood my secret signs." "We are alone together," said Monkey. "There is no one to overhear us. Take pity on me and teach me the way of long life. I shall never forget your kindness." "You show a disposition," said the patriarch. "You understood my secret signs. Come close and listen carefully. I am going to reveal to you the secret of long life." Monkey beat his head on the floor to show his gratitude, washed his ears, and attended closely, kneeling beside the bed. And the patriarch began instruction. So, began Monkey's secret instruction at the hand of Subodhi, and he gains his rishis, or magical powers. But these get him into trouble. And one day, to show off to the other disciples, he changes himself into a pine tree. And the other disciples realize that he's been getting secret instruction, and they become very, very jealous. And the master Subodhi considers this to be a breach of discipline and expels him from the cave. So he returns to the mountain of flower and fruit. He's been gone a long time. And meanwhile, the monkeys have been harassed and enslaved by a demon. So for the first time, Wukong becomes a warrior. He fights off the demon and saves his subject monkeys from the demon. And then he becomes quite serious about becoming a warrior, and he realizes that he needs weapons. So he steals a magic staff from the Dragon King at his undersea kingdom. And this magic staff has amazing properties. It can grow to any size that Monkey wants. Certain Freudian implications there, no doubt. He wears it behind his ear when it's the size of a needle. But when he needs to fight, he takes it out from behind his ear, and it grows in his hand to any size he wants. And when he's got this magic staff, he's you don't want to mess with him. He's not one to mess with when he's got his magic staff. So he fights off more demons, and eventually he becomes more and more impressed with himself and begins to suffer from hubris. And he goes to heaven, where the Celestial Jade Emperor reigns and demands that the Jade Emperor give him a title in heaven. And the Jade Emperor does so, but he decides to make him a stable hand. And not even one who takes care of the horses, but one who shovels the mess left by the horses. So Sun Wukong takes this as a great insult, and he defects and abandons his post as Celestial Stable Hand, and gives himself his own title. He declares himself to be the Great Sage, Equal of Heaven. And, of course, the Jade Emperor takes great offense at this, and he calls out the Celestial Police, who he sends to arrest Sun Wukong. But Sun Wukong beats them up with his magic staff. So then the Jade Emperor tries another strategy. He decides he'll humor him. He'll allow Monkey to dwell in heaven and allow him to call himself the Great Sage, Equal of Heaven. But he's not really going to have any power. Just humor him. So that works for a while, but then once again, Monkey gets himself into trouble. And he crashes a celestial banquet and makes a big mess, and he steals the elixir of immortality and gets drunk on it, drinks it, so he presumably becomes an immortal. And he drinks too much of it, and he gets drunk. And the Jade Emperor, after this, says, okay, enough is enough. No more monkey business.
Running to and fro, hard working at the mill, never fail in the mill, yet come a rotten bill. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Salesman talking to me, trying to run me up a creek, say you can buy it, go and try it, you can pay me next week. Ah, too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Blonde hair, good looking, trying to get me hooked, want me to marry, get a home, settle down, write a book. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Same thing every day, getting up, going to school, no need of me complaining, my objections overrule. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved. Phone something wrong, dime gone, will mail, or the suitor operator for telling me a tale. Ah, too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Been to Yokohama, been fighting in the war, army bunk, army chow, army clothes, army car. Ah, too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Working in the filling station, too many tasks. Wipe the windows, check the tires, check the oil, a dollar gas. Ha! Too much monkey business, too much monkey business. I don't want your botheration, get away, leave. it for me.
Right. So, the Celestial Jade Emperor says, too much monkey business. Enough is enough. And he declares war on Sun Wukong and mobilizes the Celestial armies. And there is a war between Sun Wukong and his monkeys and the armies of heaven. And predictably, the monkeys are defeated. It's a really, really good fight, but the monkeys are defeated in the end. And Sun Wukong is taken as he's taken up to heaven, but this time as a captive, and is turned over to the Celestial Torture Chambers. And but, you know, he's not just any monkey. He's a magic monkey, and he's got magical powers, and he's drank the elixir of immortality. So even though they use acid and fire and all these diabolical methods of torture, they just can't shock the monkey.
Bye.
Whoa! Okay, but they didn't actually shock the monkey because, monkey isn't hurt at all by all of their diabolical torture methods. So what happens next? Well, I'll tell you right after a station break. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. Actually, it's 1 minute after 1 o'clock in the morning, which makes it 1:01 in the morning. On listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, my name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and we are telling the story of Sun Wukong, the magic monkey, as told by, retold from, I should say, the work Journey to the West by Wu Cheng En, written in, Ming China in the 16th century. So, the tortures don't work. So they, send Monkey to the Buddha, who reigns in heaven with the Jade Emperor, of course. And Monkey is as arrogant as ever when he is in the presence of the Buddha. And he recites to the Buddha, "Born of sky and earth, immortal, magically fused, from the mountain of flowers and fruit, an old monkey am I. In the cave of the water curtain, I ply my home trade. I found a friend and master who taught me the great secret. I made myself perfect in many arts of immortality. I learned transformations without bound or end. I tired of the narrow scope afforded by the world of man. Nothing could content me but to live in the green jade heaven. Why should heaven's halls always have only one master? In earthly dynasties, king succeeds king. The strong to the stronger must yield precedent and place. Hero is he alone who vies with powers supreme." So Monkey recited, at which Buddha burst out laughing. "After all," he said, "you're only a monkey. How can you delude yourself into supposing that you can seize the Jade Emperor's throne? He has been perfecting himself for 1,750 kalpas, and every kalpa is 129,000 years. Just see how long it takes to achieve such wisdom as his. How can you, an animal, who have only in this incarnation received half-human form, dare to make such a boast? You exceed yourself and will surely come to a bad end. Submit at once and talk no more of your nonsense. Otherwise, I shall have to deal sharply with you, and there won't be much left of the longevity you crave." "He may have begun young," said Monkey, "but that is no reason why he should keep the throne forever. There is a proverb that says, 'This year, the Jade Emperor's turn. Next year, mine.' Tell him to go clear out and make room for me. That is all I ask. If he won't, I shall go on like this, and they will never have peace." "What magic have you got," asked Buddha, "that would enable you to seize the blessed realms of heaven?" "Many," said Monkey. "Apart from my 72 transformations, I can somersault through the clouds, 108,000 leagues at a bound. Aren't I fit to be seated on the throne of heaven?" "I'll have a wager with you," said Buddha. "If you are really so clever, jump off the palm of my right hand. If you succeed, I'll tell the Jade Emperor to come and live with me in the Western Paradise," which is the realm of Buddha up in heaven, "and you shall have his throne without more ado. But if you fail, you will go back to earth and do penance there for many a kalpa before you come to me again with your talk." "This Buddha," Monkey thought to himself, "is a perfect fool. I can jump 108,000 leagues, while his palm cannot be as much as 8 inches across. How could I fail to jump clear of it?" "You're sure you're in a position to do this for me?" he asked. "Of course I am," said Buddha. He stretched out his right hand, which looked about the size of a lotus leaf. Monkey put his cudgel behind his ear and leapt with all of his might. "That's all right," he said to himself. "I'm right off it now." He was whizzing so fast that he was almost invisible. And Buddha, watching with the eye of wisdom, saw a mere whirligig shoot along. Monkey came at last to 5 pink pillars, sticking up into the air. "This is the end of the world," said Monkey to himself. "All I've got to do back All I've got to do is go back to Buddha and claim my forfeit. The throne is mine. Wait a minute, he said presently. I'd better just leave a record of some kind in case I have trouble with Buddha. He plucked a hair and blew on it with magic breath, crying, change! It changed at once into a writing brush, charged with heavy ink. And at the base of the central pillar, he wrote, the great sage equal to heaven reached this place. Then, to mark his disrespect, he relieved nature at the bottom of the first pillar, and somersaulted back to where he had come from. Standing on Buddha's palm, he said, well, I've gone and come back. You can go tell the Jade Emperor to hand over the palaces of heaven. You stinking ape, said Buddha. You've been on the palm of my hand all the time. You're quite mistaken, said Monkey. I just went to the end of the world, where I saw five flesh-colored pillars sticking up into the sky. I wrote something on one of them. I'll take you there and show you if you don't believe me. No need for that, said Buddha. Just look down. Monkey peered down with his fiery, steely eyes, and there at the base of the middle finger of Buddha's hand, he saw written the words, the great sage equal to heaven reached this place. And from the fork between the thumb and the first finger came a smell of monkey urine. It took him some time to get over his astonishment. At last he said, impossible, impossible. I wrote that on the pillar sticking up into the sky. How did it get onto Buddha's finger? He's practicing some magic on me. Let me go back and look. Dear monkey. He crouched and was just making ready to spring again when Buddha turned his hand and pushed Monkey out of the western gate of heaven. And as he did so, he changed his five fingers into the five elements, metal, wood, water, fire, and earth. They became a five-peaked mountain named Wuzishan, Mountain of the Five Elements, which pressed upon him heavily enough to hold him tight. And the thunder spirits, Ananda and Kasyapa, pressed their palms of their hands together and shouted, Bravo! Buddha, having thus quelled the baleful monkey, called to the thunder spirits, Ananda and Kasyapa, to come back with him to the western heaven. Just as they were leaving, two messengers arrived from the Hall of Magic Mists, saying, We beseech the Buddha to wait a minute. Our master is on his way. Buddha turned his head, and moments later, a chariot drawn by eight phoenixes, covered by a canopy gleaming with jewels, arrived. There was a sound of many instruments and a chanting of innumerable spirit hosts. Flower petals fell through the air, and the smell of incense belched. I am profoundly beholden to you for dealing with that monster, said the Jade Emperor, while his equipage drew up. And if you will consent to stay a while, I will invite all of the immortals to join us for a feast of thanks. Buddha did not like to refuse. I could not do otherwise than to come at your majesty's request, he said. The banquet was nearing its end when one of the heavenly detectives arrived, saying, The great sage is sticking out his head. No matter, said Buddha. And he took out of his sleeve a seal on which was engraved Om Mani Padme Hum. He gave it to Ananda, the thunder spirit, and told him to stamp it on top of the mountain. So Ananda left heaven carrying the seal, and when he got to the mountain of the five elements, he stamped the seal hard upon a slab of rock that lay right on top of the mountain. At once the mountain struck root and joined its seams. There was enough air to breathe, but not a crack through which a hand or head could squeeze. I have sealed him down, Ananda announced, whereupon Buddha said goodbye to the Jade Emperor and all the spirits, and with his two disciples, the thunder spirits, left the gate of heaven. But in his mercy, he appointed a guardian spirit to watch over the mountain. When he is hungry, he said, give him an iron pill to eat. And when he is thirsty, give him molten copper to drink. When the days of his penance are fulfilled, there will be one who will come to rescue him. I have more to read than I can possibly get through. But let me forge on ahead. 500 years pass. And after 500 years, the Bodhisattva, or Buddhist saint, Guan Yin, meets with the Buddha at Thunderclap Monastery in India. India is conceived as a celestial realm itself in the novel. And the Thunderclap Monastery is almost certainly based on Nalanda University, where the historical Tripitaka, the monk Sanzang, actually did study when he was in India. So Guan Yin, the Bodhisattva, meets with Buddha at the Thunderclap Monastery, and they say to themselves, well, you know, things aren't looking too good in China. And that's because people aren't practicing Buddhism the way they're supposed to be. They don't have the right scriptures. So the Buddha sends Guan Yin east into China to seek a seeker who will travel to the west, into India, to the Thunderclap Monastery, to get the Buddhist scriptures and bring them back. And, of course, that the chosen seeker is none other than Tripitaka, based on the historical Sanzang. So, on the way into China, she stops at the Five Elements Mountain, where Sun Wukong begs for mercy, and she agrees to have him freed if he will serve Tripitaka. And then she goes on her way, and Sun Wukong remains captive under the mountain until a few months later, Tripitaka, on his journey to the west, comes along and, following instructions from the Bodhisattva, removes the seal, the sacred seal from the top of the mountain, reading Om Mani Padme Hum, and thereby frees Sun Wukong from his prison. And Sun Wukong does serve him, and they slay bandits and fight off tigers and wild animals. And Sun Wukong's mischievous monkey spirit reasserts itself. And he rebels and is reprimanded by Tripitaka, and Bodhisattva Guan Yin reappears and reminds him of his promise. So and he returns to the fold, and this goes on and on. And then they continue west, and they encounter more demons, and two of them are likewise beings which revolted against heaven and were therefore turned into monstrous form, made to assume monstrous form as a penance, and had been promised liberation by Guan Yin if they would agree to serve Tripitaka, just like Sun Wukong. One of those is Sha Wujing. The first one they find is Zhu Wuneng, which translates as pig awakened to power, who has been turned into a pig monster, generally rendered as pigsy in translation. And the other one is Sha Wujing, which means sand awakened to purity, generally translated as sandy. He had been transformed into a sand monster. So together they make a team, Sun Wukong, Tripitaka, Zhu Wuneng, and Sha Wujing, and they keep on traveling into the west, and they fight demon after demon, and it goes on and on like that, fighting demon after demon after demon, and inevitably they win over the demons, but usually Guan Yin or another one of the Bodhisattvas will make an appearance. And one of the I'm going to read one of the stories of the demons that they had to fight. But before I do, should we take another musical break? Let's take another musical break. I'm wondering if we're going to have time for this whole musical break. Probably not. We'll just hear a little bit of it. Okay, so they're journeying off into the west, and the realms become stranger and stranger and stranger the further they go, right? So first they're fighting wild animals and tigers and bandits, and soon they're fighting demons and ogres and even stranger beings. And the further they go into the west, the stranger things become. So, our four heroes, Sun Wukong, the monk Tripitaka, Zhu Wuneng, and Sha Wujing, Pigsy and Sandy, are journeying off into the west, and eventually they find their way barred by the Mountains of Fire, which are an entire range of flaming mountains that they can't possibly cross. And they find out, through local lore, that the only way to extinguish the flames in the Mountains of Fire are with a magic fan, which they can only get from a she-demon by the name of Rakshasi, which, as we recall, translates from the Sanskrit as demon. And those were the demons who appeared in the Ramayana. And the reason I'm reading this this particular passage is because we shall see that the fighting style of Sun Wukong and Hanuman in the Ramayana are almost identical. So, he is approaching the cave of Rakshasi to get the magic fan to extinguish the flames on the Mountains of Fire. The cave entrance was covered with lichen and moss. Wild cranes had built their nests in the bordering pines, while orioles spoke from the sad willow trees. Monkey looked down at the bordering stream, thinking it to be a place where old dragons would hide. As Monkey stood before the entrance, contemplating his next move, a young maiden stepped out, holding a flower basket in one hand with a hoe over her shoulder. Although she was dressed in rags, Monkey could see that her heart was set on the way. He went up to her with his palms pressed together and said, "Would you please announce me to your princess? I am actually a monk on my way to the west to acquire some scriptures. I have come to borrow her palm leaf fan so that my companions and I can cross the flaming mountains." "Please give me your name," the young girl said, "so that I may announce you. Also the name of your monastery." "I am the Handsome Monkey King, but my name in religion is Aware of Vacuity. We are traveling from the east." The young girl went back inside the cave and knelt before Rakshasi. "There is a Monkey King outside the cave. He wishes to borrow your palm leaf fan so that he can cross the flaming mountains. He comes from the land of the east." Rakshasi's face turned red with rage. "That insolent ape! That devilish slayer of monsters and demons! He has undoubtedly come here to upset my schemes and steal my power. Doesn't he think I know who he is?" She commanded her assistants to bring out her weapons, and sporting two treasure swords of blue steel, she marched out of the cave, shouting, "Where's the monkey? Where's the monkey?" "Greetings, Your Highness," Monkey said, stepping out from the shadow of a tree as he pressed his palms together and bowed. "Who asked for your greetings?" she said. "Back away and let me have a good look at you. You're not at all formidable. I don't doubt that you've earned your reputation somehow or another." "Now listen here," Monkey began. "Don't listen here, me," she shot back. "Stop flapping your tongue and stretch out your head while I take a few whacks with my sword. If you can stand the pain, the fan is yours. If not, you can send a message from hell where you can take up the matter of my fan with your King Yama, the Lord of the Dead." "Enough said, sister," Monkey replied, and folding his arms, he walked forward. "Here's my head. Hack at it all you like, but when you're finished with your carving, you must lend me your fan." Rakshasi drew both her swords out at once and brought them down on Monkey's head. Blow upon blow rained down, but to no avail. When she realized that she had been tricked, she turned away and started to run. "Where are you going, sister?" Monkey shouted after her. "Let me have my fan." "My fan, my treasure," she gasped. "Never." "In that case, you're going to have to taste my cudgel." Seizing her with one hand, Monkey reached behind his ear and quickly turned his needle into a rod. But Rakshasi struggled free and faced him with raised swords. They fought head to head, neither one giving way an inch. When she saw that she could not subdue Monkey on even terms, Rakshasi took out her fan, made a single swish, and blew Monkey out of sight. She replaced her swords and marched back into the cave in triumph. Monkey blew across the sky like a fallen leaf in a whirlwind. He went twirling in the air through the long night, and it was morning before he came to rest upon a mountainous peak. When he looked around, he realized that he was on Little Sumero Mountain. "What a terrible woman," Monkey said, letting out a deep sigh. "Terrible and powerful. However did she manage to send old Monkey back to this place?" As he looked around, wondering what he might do next, it suddenly occurred to him that the Bodhisattva Ling Chi had his residence on the mountain. At that moment, he heard the temple bells resounding in the distance. He scrambled down the slope and headed straight for the monastery, where he was recognized by the monk at the front gate. After he had been announced, Monkey was ushered in to see the Bodhisattva. "Allow me to congratulate you," Ling Chi said. "I assume you have acquired sacred scriptures from the Buddha and are now returning to the East." "Not yet," Monkey said. "I am sorry to say we are not even in sight of our goal." "In that case, what brings you to our humble mountain?" "We have been through countless ordeals," Monkey said, "and we have come at last to the Flaming Mountains, so we were nearing our destination. And yet, in another way, I feel we have never been further away, for we are unable to proceed. The natives tell us that there is only one way to extinguish the fire, and that is with the magical palm leaf that is in the possession of the immortal Iron Fan. It turns out that this immortal is the wife of the Bull Demon King, and she has no intention of letting me use her secret weapon. It was by the wind of that fan that I was blown all the way back to this mountain. For this reason, I am calling on you now. Perhaps you can tell me the distance between here and the Flaming Mountains." Ling Chi smiled. "That woman is called Rakshasi, or Princess Iron Fan. Her palm leaf fan is a miraculous spiritual treasure that was formed..."
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.